So we are working our way, 1 Samuel chapter 21, through a season of David's life where he's on the run. Things have reached ahead between him and King Saul. David has been anointed to be the next king over Israel, and yet Saul, also recognizing that potential calling, experiencing the anointing of God being removed from his own life, being tormented by evil, distressing spirits. Saul has been throwing spears at David. David has concluded he cannot stay around Saul. He must go. And so he runs. We've noted that the giant slayer runs in fear of the mad king. He's a fugitive, on the run, by himself. And the first place that he goes is to a town of Nob. That's how chapter 21 of 1 Samuel opens. And specifically, he comes to Ahimelech, who is the priest. Nob was a town of priests. It was one of the Levitical territories, one of their townships. David comes to Ahimelech. Initially, Ahimelech is a bit freaked out that David is coming by himself. Why? Well, he's in the king's court. He's the king's son-in-law. He typically traveled with an entourage. It caught his attention right from the jump that here's David alone. So Ahimelech brings that up, like, hey, what's going on? David is hungry. But instead of owning the story, instead of telling the truth, instead of giving this older man the courtesy of knowledge that he was running from Saul, that there had been a split, David lies. And he tells Ahimelech that he's on a super secret mission. That's why he's alone. In fact, the guys that are with him, well, they're out in the fields. And he's coming for bread, for nourishment, for food. Well, Ahimelech obliges, gives David some of the bread. The tabernacle is probably located there in Nob, and this was bread from the table of showbread. The 12 loaves that were placed within the tabernacle were holy bread given to God, each representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Those were off limits, but when the priests would bake new loaves and switch it out, those loaves that were removed, more common bread, were given to the priest so the priest could eat them. And so they give 5 of these loaves to David. Now, if you're thinking that David is an heir here, Jesus kind of dispels that, because Jesus, in an exchange with the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 12, actually brings up this instance of David going in and getting the bread to say that God cares more about human need than laws and rituals and routines. But David lies. And we're going to see this morning that there are consequences to lying. And let's not sugarcoat what David has done here. Not only does he lie once, he lies twice to Ahimelech. It's a terrible thing. Now, verse 7 gives us a detail that we must bring back up, because in the course of the exchange with the high priest, David notices that there is a henchman of Saul's that has come to Nob, a man by the name of Doeg. We don't know a lot about Doeg other than we'll discover he is an evil man. He is not an Israelite, he is an Edomite, and he is capable of all kinds of wickedness and evil. It's likely that this man is tracking, kind of a bounty hunter, a marshal. He's looking for David. Now, in the course of the story, David comes for bread. He notices that Doeg's in town, that Doeg has noticed David's there. And what's the immediate reaction of David? He then goes to the high priest and he says, listen, Ahimelech, do you have any weapons? Now, that's also odd because, well, why is David on a super secret mission? And he's left his tools, the tools of the trade, at home. And so Ahimelech is like, well, we don't really have anything here, except for one sword that happens to be the sword of Goliath. You know, you're familiar with this sword. For David, after throwing the stone and knocking down the giant, cut his head off with his own sword. And then it seems dedicated that sword to the Lord, which is why here it is located there with the tabernacle. He's like, we have a weapon. Here you go. And David's like, this is a great sword. And he runs. Now, this is where we jump back into our story, verse 10. Then David arose and fled that day from before Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Now, if as we're working our way through, if you read that verse and you're like, huh?
Like, wait a second. Did I get that correct? Yes, you did. This is a bizarre twist in the narrative, the story of David. David, fearing for his life, on the run from Saul, seeing that Doeg might be on his tail, he makes the decision to do what? To leave the land of Israel. To flee the promised land, and not just flee, if that wasn't bad enough, but to go into enemy territory. The Philistines. And not just to go to any Philistine city, of which there were five kind of kingdom states, but to go to Gath and to seek refuge within the territory of Achish, the king of Gath. Now, this should ring a bell for who was the notable champion from the city of Gath? It was Goliath. So the Philistines have attacked Israel. They send out Goliath. Gath is leading the way. Achish is the king. And David is a notable character in the story. And he's thinking to himself, what? The last place on earth Saul is going to think I'm going to retreat into would be the Philistine territory, and specifically the city of Gath. Now, there's a lot to this story that we don't know. There's a lot of questions to how these verses unfold, how they play out, left to speculation. You should note that it's during this time that David will actually write two different psalms. So he flees. Now, we don't know if there was an agreement, if David had gone into Gath, had reached some kind of an accord with Achish, if he was given official asylum. I mean, he's now the enemy of Saul. You know, the enemy of my enemies is my friend. We don't know if David goes to Gath incognito, if he's wearing some disguise, if he's trying to not raise suspicion. We really don't know exactly what's happening, other than the fact that he goes to Gath. And verse 11, at some point in this process, the servants of Achish said to him, "Is this not David, the king of the land?" Now, at some point, because of the Psalms that he writes, he is arrested, or at least is brought into some type of protective detail. Achish may be giving David some asylum, but the servants are coming, and they're like, "Wait a second, what are we doing with this guy?" And then they add, "Why? Did they not sing of him to one another and dances, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? In Psalm 18, verse 7, we were noted of this incredible top 40 song that was working its way through the radios of the land. This chorus, apparently, it went beyond the borders of Israel, and they were singing the tune even in Gath. So the servants of Achish are like, "Wait a second, why are we giving refuge to this guy? I don't know if you remember, he killed our champion. He's been a thorn in our side." Also keep in mind, between killing Goliath to this moment, that's not all of David's experiences with the Philistines. He's led conquests into the land. God's given him victories. Case in point, there are at least roughly 200 families of the Philistines that David had come and found their young men and taken their foreskins from. Like, people are not exactly happy. Like, that's something you keep a record of. You're like, "That guy, retribution. We're not giving him safe space." Brutal. Now, David, verse 12, he took these words to heart. So he hears what's happening. He understands what's going on. And we're told that he was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So it's at this point David's thinking, this might not have been a good call. I've been found out. People are not happy I'm here. And I'm a bit worried what Achish is now going to do. So what does he do? How does David work his way through the situation? Well, here's the strategy. So David, we're told, verse 13, changed his behavior before them. Pretended madness in their hands, scratched on the doors of the gate, and let his saliva fall down on his beard. David starts acting like he's a madman, like he's demon-possessed, foaming at the mouth. He's scratching at the gate. He's disheveled. He's freaking out. He changes his behavior. He looks like he's mad. Now, in response to that, Achish,
looking at David, said to his servants, "Look, you see the man is insane. Why have you brought him to me? Have I need of a madman that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house?" Now, there was a lot of superstition in the ancient world, especially in the pagan cultures that had a huge element of demon worship, of which the Philistines were noted. And part of the superstition is that if you encountered a madman, someone insane, the conclusion was that they were probably possessed with some type of an evil demonic spirit. This was a common thing throughout the land. And because they were being afflicted, possessed by some evil, wicked spirit, you would leave the person alone. Like, you wanted nothing to do with them because you really didn't want to upset the spirit. Because if that spirit was afflicting them and you crossed them the wrong way, then maybe that demonic spirit's going to come and afflict you. So Achish is looking at David. He's mad. He's insane. He's possessed. I don't want anything to do with him. Like, the man's nuts. Like, he might have been some great victor, but we're not going to kill him, because if I kill him, I don't want that demon coming after me. So just get rid of him. Let him go. Release him. And so David will flee. Again, it should be noted, just, David's in a tough spot. I really do believe David's in a dark place. David's on the run. He's filled with fear. There's an element where he has to be questioning his calling, his anointing. I mean, he goes to the Philistines. He's not thinking clearly. He's reacting. And he finds himself in trouble. He finds himself out of the land of promise. He finds himself into the world. When we go into the world, we change our behavior. If we're seeking solace in the world, we'll often try to change our behavior. I heard a pastor this week, he made a great point about our relationship with the world. And our relationship with the world should be more that we're a thermostat and not a thermometer. You know, if you take a thermometer into a place, the thermometer will change depending on the temperature of the space. The thermometer changes to its environment. But what does a thermostat do? Does a thermostat change to its environment? No, it's set and then it determines the environment in which it exists. And that as Christians, in regards to our relationship with the world, David goes to Gath and he operates more as a thermometer. He changes his behavior. And it gets him in trouble. It places him really where evil would have befallen him if not for, let's say, the providence of God kind of working through it. Like, there was abundance of grace here on behalf of God. David didn't deserve release, but he acted crazy. What a shame. Well, he flees, he leaves, he runs, he departs, chapter 22, verse 1. He departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. The cave of Adullam, there's a bit of debate in regards to its precise location, but most scholars, archaeologists, believe that it was likely a network of caves located in the regions of Bethlehem, which would make a lot of sense for David, right? So David is looking for a place to hide. He knows Saul's on his tail. He goes to Gath. That doesn't work. He's going to come back to the land. So he goes to familiar territory. For David had grown up in the fields of Bethlehem as a shepherd boy. No doubt David was familiar with these caves, had grown up running around. It was a good place to go. It was familiar territory. It was familiar terrain. He knew where he could hide, which vantage points would give him the ability to see if anyone was approaching. This is just a good place for him to go, the caves of Adullam. And yet, he's totally alone. Like, David is absolutely alone. He's run from the land. He suffered consequences. He had to kind of humiliate himself. He's gotten himself out of Gath. He's at the caves of Adullam. And this is a low point.
He's all by himself. You can read, there's several different psalms that were written, Psalms 56, Psalms 34, written by David, expressions of his heart while he's there, wrestling with darkness and depression. David's human. And we're told that the best of men are men at best. And David is capable of low points. He's a great warrior, he's a musician, and he is emotive. He's emotional. And it comes through in his songs and his singing and his writing. Adullam, the name Adullam, means resting place. So God does lead him back from the world. He gives him a place of rest. So when his brothers and all his father's house heard that David had come to the caves of Adullam, they went down there to him. So David's family, he had a set of brothers, he had sisters, a father and a mother. Again, this is the region of Bethlehem. This is where they're from. They hear David has come. No doubt word has spread through the area that there's been a falling out, a schism between David and Saul. No doubt word has been, a bounty has been issued. Saul is working a network of connections trying to ascertain David's location. Word has gotten to David's family. Now, if you're family of the guy that's been declared a traitor, you're walking on eggshells. You're a bit worried for your own safety. So they hear that David has come into the land. They know where he's located. So they come to David. So he's no longer alone. He has his family with him. Verse 2 says that everyone, as word begins to spread, everyone who was in distress, literally everyone stressed out, everyone in debt, debts that couldn't be paid, everyone who was discontented, gathered to him. The word discontented, it means to possess a bitterness of soul. Gathered to David, so he became captain over them, and there were about 400 men with him. David is attracting quite an entourage. It's great, he's got his family, his brothers, he can trust them, they got his back. But then God starts bringing all of these people who have been disenfranchised with the reign of Saul. These are all the people that have had contact with David, admired David, but this is a motley group. It's not as though right from the jump that God is bringing like a real solid support structure around David. Some real men of integrity, men of character, men that are wise and some wisdom. No, these are men that are totally stressed out about what's going on. Like they're on edge. And they got no money. They're running from debt. They're like, my house has been confiscated. My fields are, there's liens on my fields. I'm out of here. I'm going to David, this revolutionary. I got nothing here anyway. Saul has ripped me off. I'm stressed out about life. I'm in debt. This isn't worked out. And I'm bitter about it. Like, just a great group of people to have as your small group, right? People that are stressed out, angry, bitter. And David becomes the captain over them. No doubt, this group of men, they will later be known as David's mighty men of valor. This is the beginnings of the formation of an army that will be the greatest army in the history of Israel. These were some bad dudes. Now, we can debate whether or not this was the motley crew that God really wanted around David. For at the end of David's life, when he's handing the kingdom over to Solomon, he will have a lot of these guys whacked, mafia style, because he didn't trust them. He knew how brutal they were. Like, this was a group. Now, there's some great things that come out of it, and God will use it, but man, discontented, stressed, in debt, leaving Saul, this the king that was no longer anointed, God, you know, wasn't God's king, to David. Now, there's a bit of an analogy here, or an allegory to be played with. You know, within the world, there is a king of this world. and his name is Satan. And he had been given dominion, and that dominion has been taken. He has no anointing. God is against him. And in the midst of this world where you've got a counterfeit king, there is also an anointed king that has God's hand. David, this picture of Christ in some ways. What's a good thing when you're living in the kingdom under Saul, and that hasn't worked out well? It's left you stressed, in debt, bitter. You know, a good strategy at that point is to leave the reign of that king, the mad king, and even if you have to go out in the wilderness, to come to Jesus. Again, there's a picture of Christ. And how awesome it is that David welcomed the distressed and the debt, the debtors and the bitter, that he welcomed them. He brought them into his fold. And that there's a picture of us, isn't there? That we don't come to Christ with what we have to offer, do we? For we would never come, for we have nothing. And yet we come for what he has to offer. These men came to David. Why? Because they were disenfranchised with the life that they had been given under Saul. And even if it meant they were on the run and they were rebels and renegades, that David was going to offer a better life. And that is also the way with Christ. Might not be the easier life, for they will experience the rejection that David had experienced. They will experience the opposition that David experiences. They become one with David. They're given the blessing of David, the inheritance of David. But just like with Jesus, we are given the blessed life. That's not an easy one. Then David went from there to Mitzvah of Moab. And he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me." So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Another weird wrinkle, isn't it? For David now goes again outside of the land of promise, and he goes to the king of Moab. Well, why? Not because he's wanting his own protection, but he's wanting his parents to be given protective status within Moab. Now, Saul had several excursions against Moab. The king of Moab was not a fan of Saul, and David is not a fan of Saul. David thinks that this would be a good dynamic. Also keep in mind that David has Moabite blood running through his veins. His great-great-grandmother, Ruth, was a Moabitess. And so there would be still family connections, at least a reputation. Jesse probably would have even known, had some familiar dynamics with the Moabites. So this seems like a good place. David's like, my parents, they can't go on the run with me. My brothers are able. I need to have my parents taken care of. So this seems like a natural fit. And they're given a place that they can take refuge. We're told that David then abides in this word, the stronghold, the end of verse 4. We're not given a specific location as to where this stronghold is, but it should be noted that the Hebrew word is masud. And a lot of scholars think that this is an abbreviated translation of Masada. So in the southern regions of Judea, there is a fortress, it's a plateau, it's called Masada. Herod the Great built an incredible encampment. It was a place that was, you could not conquer it. In fact, when Jerusalem gets sacked in 70 AD, the refugees flee out of Jerusalem. They go up to this fortress, Masada, because you couldn't get, like you had a, it was impregnable. Like you could not attack it. In fact, Rome encircled it. And the only way that they were going to be able to conquer Masada was to build a gigantic ramp of earth to get to the top of it so that they could launch an assault. This would take like 10 years to do. So Titus is like, all right, here's the plan. I'll be back in a decade. You can go visit Masada today and you can see the stone
markings of where the actual Roman encampments were, how it all took place. It's likely that David, again, on the run, he'll very rarely ever leave, by the way, the region of Judea. The tribe of Judah is his tribe, so he mainly, all these little places we'll read about, he'll stay in familiar territory, a better place, less likely that people are going to turn you in, although we'll see that that plays out in weird ways as the story unfolds. But he goes to this stronghold. He's thinking, I'll stay here. Saul can't get me. I'm untouchable. However, the prophet Gad said to David, do not stay in the stronghold. Depart, go to the land of Judah. So David departed and went into the forest of Hereth. Now we're introduced to a really bizarre character, the prophet Gad. A few other passages he's mentioned. He'll be mentioned in 2 Samuel 24:11, 1 Chronicles 29:29, 2 Chronicles 29:25. It seems as this becomes, this guy Gad becomes the personal prophet of David while he's on the run and then into the kingdom. That a contemporary of his will be Nathan, who's a character later on. Why that's worth noting is that David does have a spiritual advisor with him, probably assigned to him by Samuel. But a lot of the record of what we're getting here requires some like first-person recording. And so the prophet Gad is no doubt writing, chronicling, recording the events of David's life on the run because he was there with David. David is in the stronghold. The prophet Gad says, don't stay here. So he retreats to the forest area of Hereth. So Saul, when he heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now Saul was staying in Geba under a terebinth tree in Ramah, with his spear in his hand and all of his servants standing about him. So he's in Geba. So Saul said to his servants who stood with him, hear now, you Benjaminites. Will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? All of you have conspired against me, and there is no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there is not one of you who is sorry for me or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day. So Saul's in Geba and he's throwing a pity party. So he's talking to his closest advisors, these people from the tribe of Benjamin, which is note because Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. It's a small tribe. And he's like, guys, where is David? Y'all haven't been doing me good, man. Y'all have been letting me down. And you think like that David's going to be good for the tribe of Benjamin? Is he going to give you fields and vineyards and sweeten the pot like I have? Come on, man. We need to up the game. We need to find David. You guys are failing on the job. What's the deal? Well, verse 9, then answered Doeg. So we're back to Doeg the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Saul. He said, I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob, and Ahimelech, the son of Hetub, he inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. So Doeg is in Nob. He sees David interacting with the high priest. Is he there to hear the conversation? Unlikely. But he notices that David has a powwow Ahimelech. His assumption, again, he says, he inquired of the Lord, gave him permission, provisions, gave him a weapon. So the king sent to call Ahimelech, the priest, the son of Hetub, and all his father's house, the priests who were in Nob, and they all came to the king. So Saul is wanting to get to the bottom of what's happening. Saul says, hear now, son of Hetub. He says, I'm here, Lord. So Saul said to him, why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, and that you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as it is this day? Saul's making a ton of assumptions here.
So Ahimelech answered the king. He says, "And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law, who goes at your bidding and is, is honorable in your house? Did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Far be it from me. Let not the king impute anything to his servant or in any of the house of my father, for your servant knew nothing of all of this, little or much." So Saul calls for Ahimelech to come. Doeg has made accusations. Saul makes even greater accusations. "Bro, you and David are conspiring against me. You gave him provisions. You gave him a sword. What's the deal?" Now, Ahimelech has no idea what's going on. He's like, excuse me? Why should I have been suspicious of David? He's your son-in-law. He's noble. He's faithful. He's one of your command. He came and said he's on a super secret mission, man. Like, I had no idea that there had been a falling out between the two of you. Like, David leaves, he hangs him out to dry, doesn't he? Because of his lie. Ahimelech knows that Saul is a madman, a mad king. He's been accused of treason, of aligning with a traitor. Now, if David had been honest with Ahimelech, I think Ahimelech would have been kind to David. I think he would have given David provisions, probably would have even given him the sword. But at least the man would have known what he was getting into. At least he would have been making a decision of his own free will, of his own conscience. David, because of his lie, has removed this man from making any decisions. He couldn't have prepared himself. And so Saul, what happens? So the king says, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech. You and all of your father's house." And I can see, say that again? We're going to die? Then the king said to the guards who stood about him, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord." Saul is off his rocker. At this point, we are watching his decline into just total, he's disconnected with all reality. He's totally gone mad. How so? I think there's a lesson, something that at least should be pointed out. Saul's animosity towards David, it began how? It began through jealousy. That's how it began. Again, David is in the courts of Saul. He's playing music. He's going and he's tending sheep. He's no threat. Saul could have gone out and taken on Goliath. He didn't. David did. And then immediately following that, people are praising David. And Saul is jealous of this. He's filled with envy. So the beginnings of his decline into madness, although we can say it goes back further, the anointing of God being removed, the distressing spirit being sent. But in this interaction, it begins with jealousy towards one person. He looks at David. David has done nothing wrong, but he's jealous. He's jealous of his fame. He's jealous of his youth. He's jealous of his anointing. The obvious hand of God on his life, he's jealous of it. And what does he do in his jealousy? He starts throwing spears. Starts eating at him. And then it slowly begins to morph from just jealousy to anger and violence. It's one thing to be jealous about someone's good fortune. But jealousy, if not checked and dealt with, will then lead a person to trying to sabotage or being actively against. It never just stays in the heart. It begins to work itself out of one's mouth and through one's hands. Saul's throwing spears. And then he starts running after David. He's a dog with a bone. It's obsessive. At the expense of his other kingly responsibilities. And then ultimately that anger towards David will spill over towards violence with others. Have you ever found yourself in a situation? Something just wasn't going right at work. It was a boss, a coworker. I don't know what it was. Let's just play it out. Maybe it began with a little jealousy. They started just kind of irking on you, and like you just this person became your enemy. And in the context of work, there was like very little you could do about it. But like you just would sit in your cubicle imagining, you know, like Final Destination, like something coming out of nowhere, crushing them, you know. And then you'd snap back to your computer screen. But like you were angry. Maybe they were getting favor that you weren't. They were getting promotions and you were being passed over. There's just this hostility, this thing in your heart towards this one person. And then you found yourself going home and all of that anger towards that one person spilling over to your wife and to your kids. It wasn't, they weren't the object of it, but they end up being the victims of it. Like, please understand, anger and jealousy, it never stays contained. And if you can't actively get to that other person, you will get to other people. And this is what's happening here. Saul can't get to David. It's driving him nuts. And he makes up this whole story about the priest aligning with David. And he's like, y'all need to die. Everyone around Saul is like, no. Like, this is the second time the servants of Saul have said no. Like, outright, we're not going to do what you just commanded. The first time is when another story, again, him being crazy, wants his own son executed because he ate some honey. And the servants are like, no, we're not going to do that. This is what happens. The priest, you're all dead. Get him, guys. No, I'm not going to do that. However, So the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, because they knew they had fled, servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. So the king, verse 18, said to Doeg, you turn and kill the priests. So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck the priests and killed on that day 85 men who wore a linen ephod. Right presently there, he pulls out his sword and he cuts down by his own hand Ahimelech and all 85 priests. It is a bloodbath. Brutal. But that's not it. And also, Doeg then goes down to Nob, the city of the priests. And there he struck with the sword both men and women, children, nursing infants, oxen, donkeys, and sheep with the edge of the sword. This might be one of the most barbaric events recorded in the Old Testament. All of the priests get whacked, and all of their families die, and all of their children, and all of their possessions by the hand of Doeg under the instructions of the mad king Saul. Horrifying. We can lay absolute criminality to the hands of the instigator of Doeg. Doeg's the man that's doing this brutal act. Obviously, Saul is more than culpable. He's guilty. He gave the edict, the charge, the order. But who else has blood on their hands? I think David. Why? Because he lied. In case in point, let's finish the chapter. Now one of the sons of Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, named Abishar, escaped. So one guy escapes and he flees to David. And Abithar told David that Saul had killed the Lord's priests. So David said to Abithar, I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there
that he would surely tell Saul. And then he says, I have caused the death of all of the persons of your father's house. So stay with me, do not fear, for he who seeks my life seeks your life, but with me you shall be safe. Before we get to the way that David handles this, it should be noted. Go all the way back to 1 Samuel 2 and 3, beginning of our travels. We were introduced to the high priest, a man by the name of Eli. And Eli had two very wicked sons that he would not corral, would not rebuke, would not put into order. They were ripping off the people. They were misrepresenting God. And despite even the warnings that God had given Eli, he refused to intervene, to do anything. And so God comes and speaks to Eli, again through little Samuel, and says that you, your sons, will die and your priestly lineage will be cut off. That doesn't happen immediately. But do you know when it's cut off? And this story. Now, does that mean that God was guilty of this act? No, God sees the end from the beginning from the end. God knows how everything was going to work. But when God was speaking to Eli that your family will be cut off, he could see Doeg. You see, not just is Doeg guilty and Saul guilty and David guilty, but a great-grandfather is guilty. That the sins of the father carry forth and have consequences. Men, your actions will reverberate through your generations. It's a heavy word. But let's close by just looking back at our main character, David. So word gets to David what's happened. Again, you can read Psalm 52. He pours out his heart before God. He writes this upon receiving word of Doeg and what's happened. Does David make excuses? No, not at all. Like, David gets word that what's happened, and he immediately was like, I knew that was what, I knew it. When I saw Doeg, I knew it. He says, I have caused the death. It's not Doeg and it's not Saul, it was me. I lied. I sinned. And David owns it. He doesn't make excuses for it. He doesn't try to explain it away. He's not like, well, I was super hungry and I was on the run and I was vulnerable. He owns it. And because he owns it, God forgives and forgets. See, the biggest difference, and we've said it before, but this is a great example of it. The biggest difference between Saul and David. Saul was a wicked man. David was too. Did some terrible things. But the biggest difference between the two, what makes one the enemy of God and the other a man seeking God's heart, is that in the presence of their sin, Saul would make excuses, he would deflect, he would blame, he would never humble himself. That's why he could never receive God's grace. For God resists the proud, but he gives grace to whom? The humble. See, David's life is an example of grace upon grace upon grace. And guess what you need? Do I sin so that grace may abound? Where there is sin, there is grace. It's an amazing thing. Like, in the presence of sin, you have to have sin for God's grace. It's unmerited favor. David sins a lot, but because he's willing to submit and humble himself and own it, he's waves of grace, waves of grace. Saul never receives grace because he could never humble himself. Please realize, when you screw up, God is not shocked. God is not up in heaven thinking, oh, I missed that one. I didn't think he was capable of such a thing. He's not caught off guard.
He sent his son to die on the cross because he knew who we were and that there was nothing we could do to save ourselves. David gets this word and he's broken. You read the Psalms. His heart is torn. But he doesn't blame anyone. He owns it. And because he owns it, God was more than willing to extend grace. Own it. Confession is not breaking news to God. Confession is you acknowledging before God the error of your way. It's the act of humility. So, Father, Lord, we just leave that there.